Wednesday, October 19th, 2022. You are listening to the Daily Dose Sports Podcast, and I am your host, Clint Daly, coming to you from Mile High City here in Denver, Colorado, and we are back for another week of talking sports with a dose of common sense. Hey, happy Wednesday to you. I hope your week is going well. You, your family, your friends, you're all staying healthy. Hey, you're halfway through the work week, almost to another weekend. But you know, we are now in the middle of October. Halloween is coming quickly. The weather is cooling down, at least here where I'm at. And we have the Major League Baseball postseason. Football is in the heat of their season. And don't look now, but like the NHL is getting going, the NBA is getting going. It is a wonderful time of the year. I hope wherever you are taking the time to, of course, enjoy all the sports going on, but take the time to look around, see those changing fall colors, soak it in, enjoy it. It is a good thing. It is a happy day today on October 19th. Hey, before we jump in today, just want to remind you, make sure you're stopping by DailyDoseSports.com where we have new articles going up every week. I'm writing a local article pretty much every week, but it could be about anything. But we also have links to the podcast. We have links to the video. We have links to the Daily Dose gear. You may need a new t-shirt. You may need a new sweatshirt or a new hoodie because, like I said, that weather is cooling down. You're getting that nice, brisk air. Hey, go get a Daily Dose hoodie. We've got a number of styles to choose from. You can pick it in whatever color that you want. Make sure you're stopping by DailyDoseSports.com every week and checking on what is going on over there. We've got new stuff coming out all the time. Hey, today on the show, I actually have some business to attend to this week. But never fear, because like I said, we are now in the heat of the NFL season right now, and I have some NFL-flavored Daily Dose Top 5s for you today. We're going to go back to some throwback episodes of the Daily Dose, and when I say throwback, I mean, we are going to go way back. We are going to listen to some Daily Dose top fives from the early days of the Daily Dose. We're going to listen to the top five memorable NFL divisional playoff games ever, the top five NFL playoff collapses, the top five underrated quarterbacks, and the top five left-handed quarterbacks. Those are all back from 2015. Yeah, the Dose was new. I was younger then. And then we're actually going to listen to the top five quarterback controversies in NFL history. That is from 2016. So we're going to be looking at some real, real old stuff. I would encourage you, sit back and relax and enjoy a throwback episode of the Daily Dose. Speaking of great games, our Daily Dose Top 5, a very popular segment here. We do it every single week. Our Daily Dose Top 5, we are going to this week focus on, we've got the NFL divisional playoff games coming up this weekend. And like I said, for me, I think the NFL divisional round is the best weekend in the NFL because you have the best eight teams and you've got four games staggered over 2 days. It's phenomenal. It's phenomenal. I love it. It's kind of like the Sweet 16 in college hoops. It's packed and good teams. It's not bad football. You've got, you know, good teams in it. Should be a lot of fun. So for our Daily Dose top five this week, the five most memorable NFL divisional playoff games ever. And I'll tell you what, it was tough to come up with these. I went through the list. It was enjoyable to come up with these, but it was tough because there's some good games out there that couldn't make our list. I mean, think about 1988 NFC Bears over Eagles in the Fog Bowl. Wasn't a great game, and to be honest, I don't know how much of the game we saw because of the fog. You remember that fog came into Chicago? The cameras couldn't see the game. There were times we were guessing what happened, and you could even hear the announcers. I think they just scored. I don't know. I mean, it was incredible. It might not have been a great game, but it was very memorable. And I could have, I guess, just gone complete homer on this list and gone with the Denver Broncos in 91 with the drive two. Broncos over Oilers. You might remember that game. Houston comes into town, Warren Moon, Curtis Duncan, Drew Hill, Haywood Jeffries. Remember that team? And I mean, they were throwing it all over. And right off the bat, they're up 21-6 on the Broncos. Somehow, Elway gets them to come back very, very late. finds a way, converts on a couple fourth downs. Note to Detroit, converts on fourth downs. And somehow finds a way to win that game over the Oilers. They called it the drive part two when he took them from his own two-yard line. So a couple games like that, they couldn't even make our list. But we have five really, really good games for our top five. So let's count them down. Daily Dose top five most memorable NFL divisional playoff games in history. The number five game. And some of these games, if you don't remember them, or some of you might remember, if you don't, go on YouTube, go find some of the clips from these games, because they absolutely were phenomenal. Even the, whether it was the finish or whatever it was, just memorable games. Number five, 1975 NFC divisional playoff game. Dallas Cowboys 17, Minnesota Vikings 14. This was the Hail Mary game. The Minnesota Vikings were the number one seed that year in 75. They were 12-2. And everyone was thinking this team might actually challenge the Steelers. Fran Tarkington says this was the best team he ever had while he was in Minnesota. And they went to four Super Bowls, but they got knocked off by the Cowboys. Cowboys are down 14-10. There's less than a minute left in this game. Cowboys have it at the 50-yard line. Roger Staubach goes back to pass. He's got Drew Pearson, throws it. Now, was there interference? Initially, you might have thought pass interference against the defense. And then when you kind of watch it again, you go, well, maybe pass interference against the offense. Pearson kind of gets a little away with a little bit of a push, but it was just a chuck it up. Pearson catches it, sneaks into the end zone. Yes, he might have got away with a push up, but the Hail Mary game at number five comes in for us. Really, really crazy. And that was kind of the game that spawned the term Hail Mary. I think Staubach even said it after the game. We just kind of threw up a Hail Mary. Cowboys beat the Vikings in 1975. Our number four game on our top five list. 1974 AFC divisional playoff game. The Oakland Raiders and the Miami Dolphins. Raiders finished the game 28-26 over the Dolphins. It's called by many the Sea of Hands game. And this was a phenomenal game. Teams exchanged the lead in this game seven different times. End of the game. 35 seconds left. Raiders down by five. The Dolphins, keep in mind, had played in three straight Super Bowls. This would have been four straight. They had kind of that Dolphin dynasty going. This one kind of ends it. Down by five. Raiders have the ball at Miami's eight-yard line. Stabler rolls out, gets tripped, gets pulled down, and he just, it's not even a pass. It would be, kind of some liberating terms to call it a pass. He just kind of shot puts it. He just chucks it out there. And when he throws it out there, you see three Miami Dolphins defenders. All three of them are going to get this. I mean, there's three of them there. It kind of pops through each one of their hands, lands with running back Clarence Davis, catches it. They call it the Sea of Hands. Raiders win the game 28-26. One of the most improbable finishes to a game that you might ever see. Ended the Miami dynasty right there. Moving on to our number three entry on our top five list, the 2001 AFC divisional round, New England Patriots over the Oakland Raiders. And I know, Raiders, you were probably just feeling good if you're a Raider fan about the Sea of Hands game. I'm going to bring you back to earth with this one. Yes, you remember it. The Tuck Rule. The Tuck Rule. Oh, that still hurts, doesn't it? Final game at Foxborough Stadium. Oakland is up 13-10, less than 2 minutes left. Keep remembering this because we look at the Patriots now and we kind of forget what it was like. But remember, the Patriots weren't winners. Tom Brady wasn't a winner. He was a young quarterback. The Patriots were kind of lovable losers. They hadn't won anything. They hadn't done anything. This wasn't the team that we see now where you say, oh, they have three Super Bowls now. That wasn't this team. This was a team that always found a way to lose. And even if they made it to the Super Bowl, trust, they were going to lose. There was no question. Patriots at the Raiders, about 42-yard line, hard to tell. Blizzard going on up in Foxborough. You couldn't hardly see the yard markers. Brady goes back to pass. Charles Woodson comes in on the blind side, pops him. Brady fumbles it. He fumbled it. We all know it. We all saw it. He fumbled it. But by rule, the rule was that as he started to throw it, he kind of pulls it down, and that's a tuck. That means it can't be a fumble. So they overrule the fumble. Raiders had recovered. They overrule the fumble. Patriots go down, kick a field goal in the blizzard, and then in overtime, find a way to beat the Raiders. And I know Raider fans. I know that call screwed you. It's kind of like the Detroit play. It's actually a little worse than Detroit play. But it's kind of like that because you still had your opportunities. You still had your chances. All you had to do is, okay, just stop them. And then in overtime, go score yourself or stop them from scoring. And you still would have won the game. But the tuck rule comes back to haunt the Oakland Raiders. Patriots went on to win their first Super Bowl. The following season, actually, the Raiders made it to that Super Bowl against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. They lost. They've never been back to the playoffs since. So that was kind of the beginning of the end for the Oakland Raiders. They stumbled ever since then. The number two game on our list of top five most memorable divisional playoff games, 1972 AFC playoffs. Steelers beat the Raiders on the Immaculate Reception. Steelers are down by a point. It's 7-6. Less than a minute left. 4th and 10. This is everything. And like we talked about with the Patriots, this is not the Patriots team that had won all these games. This is not the Steelers team that had won everything. The Steelers had never won a playoff game in this game. They had never won a playoff game. This was their first playoff win ever. The last time they had been to the playoffs was back in 1947. The Steelers weren't the team you think of now with all these rings and trophies, and that wasn't the Steelers. The Steelers were kind of those lovable losers too. 4th and 10, Bradshaw throws it over the middle to Frenchie Fuqua, who Fuqua just gets blown up by Jack Tatum. If you look at the replay, it hits them. It ricochets the ball up in the air. Now, that might not seem like a big thing, but at that time, it was illegal for an offensive player to touch the ball and then another offensive player catch the ball. That was an illegal play. Ball bounces off of Fuqua and Tatum. Franco Harris catches it and runs 60 yards for the touchdown. Was it legal? I don't know. I know this. If you had replay now, I don't think they would have overturned it because I still haven't seen an angle that I'm sure. If they would have ruled it, as an illegal play, you wouldn't have overruled that either. It's just one of those plays that when it happened, everybody kind of didn't know what happened. This game was in Pittsburgh, and when the game ended, the officials kind of came together and had a little huddle and kind of decided, what'd you see? I don't know. And in fact, they say that the officials actually went down to a phone in one of the locker rooms and spoke to Pete Rozelle, and Rozelle said, I think you've got to rule it a touchdown. Now, I don't know if that part of it's true, but that's the rumor. First ever Steeler playoff victory. They end up going to the Super Bowl, winning the Super Bowl, and then you have that dynasty with Steelers winning 4 Super Bowls back in the 70s and 80s. That's what started it all on a completely improbable play, maybe an illegal play, who knows, based on the angle that, but there's no way it didn't touch Fuqua. There's no way to prove that it did. Our number two game on our list, the Immaculate Reception, Steelers over Raiders, 13-7. So what could be our number one game? I mean, what do we have at number one if that wasn't it? I mean, if we look back, we've got the Hail Mary game, we've got the See a Hands game, we've got the Tuck Rule, and then we've got the Immaculate Reception. What could we possibly have put as the number one divisional playoff game of all time? If you haven't seen this game, go find it. Go watch it. Might be the best game I have ever witnessed in my life. And I do remember watching this one. Some of these games are a little before my time. I remember watching this one. 1981 AFC playoff game, San Diego Chargers over the Miami Dolphins. It might be the greatest game I've ever seen. It might be the greatest game ever played. I don't know. If you haven't seen it, go find it. San Diego takes a 24-0 lead in the first quarter. In the first quarter, not in the first half, first quarter. Wes Chandler takes a punt return all the way back. Chuck Muncy runs one in. James Brooks catches a pass and runs one in. Miami comes all the way back. They've got the hook and ladder play. Don Strock throws it to Duriel Harris, who pitches it to Tony Nathan. He takes it, and I'll tell you, on that play, and I remember that play, the hook and ladder, throws it to the receiver pitches it back to the running back takes it all the way. Loudest I have ever seen Miami get in my life. The cameras were shaking. The stadium was shaking. It was insane. Miami ends up tying the game at 24. They exchange touchdowns. They go into overtime tied at 38. It was sweltering hot down there. Players were passing out. Players were getting IVs. You might remember, if you remember after the game, Kellen Winslow kind of being carried off. I've heard rumors that that was fake. I've heard that it wasn't. I know this. I know they were sweating down there. It was humid. It was hot. He wasn't the only guy that needed to be carried. They say that there were players on either side kind of just hoping, I hope whoever kicks this field, I hope it goes in because we got to end this game. We're starting to get into health concerns. It goes to overtime, and the Chargers kick the field goal in overtime to advance. But listen to the stats. I mean, Dan Fouts throws for 433 yards and 3 touchdowns. Don Strock for the Miami Dolphins, 403 yards and 4 touchdowns. This game kind of is similar to some of the games we see today. You didn't see this back then. Games back in the 70s and 80s, they were low-scoring games. They focused on defense. Wasn't uncommon to see a game finish in the teens and maybe the 20s if you got it. Are you kidding? 41-38? Both quarterbacks throw for over 400 yards in a single game. That is not the football that it was. Now, the following week, San Diego goes on to Cincinnati, and they play in the AFC Championship game. Coldest game in history. It was below 6 degrees, which is bad enough. Bad enough that it was 6 degrees below zero at kickoff, which just means it got colder. But it was a 25-mile-an-hour wind blowing, too. The wind chill was insane. They say that when San Diego came out, you could see on their faces that they were like, you know, if you could just let us not play, that's fine. We don't need to play. They ended up getting blown out by Cincinnati, and Cincinnati went on to the Super Bowl. But you could just see San Diego wanted no part of that game. So our number one game on our top five list this week, the 81 AFC divisional playoff game, Chargers over Dolphins, 41-38. And like I said, it might be the best game that I have ever seen. If you haven't seen it, seriously, go to YouTube, go find it, check it out, because it is an absolute amazing game. As we do every week here at the Daily Dose, right now we are going to bring to you our Daily Dose Top 5. And you know, I struggled a little bit. I was kind of wondering, you know, which way do I go with this Daily Dose Top 5 this week? We do our Daily Dose Top 5 each week, and it could be a different thing. And I got some input on Twitter, and I had a couple people, you know, with a few suggestions. What I went with this week, the Daily Dose Top 5 NFL playoff collapses. That's what we're going with this week. You know, we saw on Sunday, obviously, the Packers up 16-0, up 12 with less than 4 minutes to go, and somehow they find a way to give it all up and lose the game. And so I went back and I was like, well, let's look at some other playoff collapses and the top five NFL playoff collapses in NFL history. Let's take a look at number 5. And I know what you're going to say when I put this one on there. You're going to say you're a homer. You can't put that one on there. Well, I'm going to, because I am a homer. 1987 AFC Championship game. The Cleveland Browns are up 7 at home. Doesn't sound like that big of a deal. Who cares? They're up 7 at home. Big deal. Well, you're facing the Denver Broncos, a team who had never really done anything. And you're up 7 at home with less than 5 minutes to go. When they kick off, the Broncos fumble the kickoff. They end up getting it on their own, too. Now, again, this might not sound too bad. You have to realize, everyone in Cleveland is going crazy. They're finally going to the Super Bowl. This is a Bronco team that hasn't moved the ball since early in the third quarter. They don't have any offense today. People in Cleveland are going nuts. You've got the dog pound. They're dressed up in their funny little dog suits. They're so crazy with their dog biscuits. Everybody is going crazy. This game is over. They're finally going to get to a Super Bowl. And somehow, John Elway goes 98 yards to tie the game. But see, that's the thing. It's not over. You don't just sit there and say, well, yeah, they put together one drive. Because don't forget, Cleveland wins the kickoff in overtime. That just tied it. Cleveland gets the kickoff in overtime. They basically go 3-and-out, end up kicking, and the Broncos go down and win it. But it seriously was. It was one of the biggest choke jobs. One of the biggest collapses. That game, if you watched it, that game was over. There was no question. When Denver fumbles the ball on their own 2, game's over, everyone's celebrating. Somehow, Marty Schottenheimer finds a way to lose to John Elway and the Denver Broncos. That is number 5 on our list. Number 4 on our list was just last year. 2014, the AFC wildcard game. Somehow, the Kansas City Chiefs ended up losing this game. They were up 28. They were up 38 to 10 in the third quarter. And you know, the biggest thing I've found in most of these games, and there is a trend. One of the things you find, one, there's usually a turnover or something that kind of turns the momentum. But usually you see a common theme, and that is that the team that is up takes their foot off the accelerator and changes what they do. And that was the case here, because the Chiefs are up 28, and all of a sudden you kind of start playing a different defense. You kind of start changing what's been working on offense. And the Colts outscore the Chiefs. Andrew Luck gets hot. The Colts outscore the Chiefs 35-6 in the final 27 minutes. Colts come back and win it 45-44. Our number three entry on our Daily Dose Top 5 playoff collapses in the NFL, the 2002 NFC wildcard game. The New York Giants are up 24 on the 49ers. Somehow they end up giving this away. And like I said, there's always kind of that play that changes the momentum, that changes the tide. If you remember this game, the Giants are driving. They're going to just add to their lead. And Jeremy Shockey drops a wide open touchdown. And then you had the issues with the New York Giants. Remember their long snapper? Like, I don't know if he got the yips, but he like forgot how to snap the ball. You kept having bad snaps on field goals. You kept having bad snaps on punts, even on shotgun formations. They kept having these bad snaps. And the game ends just so bizarre because the Giants actually had a chance to win this game at the end. The Niners come back and win 39-38. The Giants had a chance to win. And again, you get a bad snap. And the holder, who is the punter, Matt Allen, I think his name was, he actually, you know, just picks up the ball and is like, well, I'm going to throw a pass. Throws a pass. You have San Francisco 49ers just pulling down anyone who resembled a receiver. No pass interference called. It was just a bizarre finish to a really, really weird game. But somehow the Giants, you know, just give up a 24-point lead and find a way to lose down the stretch. It just seems like if you just make one play, you would stop the bleeding. You would get yourself going. They couldn't make that one play. Number two on our list, the 2006 AFC Championship. And this is one of those ones that you look at this and you're like, this doesn't fit. This isn't what we've kind of, you know, come to understand what happens in the NFL. The 2006 AFC Championship game, the New England Patriots, Tom Brady, Bill Belichick, up 21-3 on the Indianapolis Colts and Peyton Manning. Of course, that game's over. And somehow, again, the Patriots changed what they did. They took their foot off the accelerator. They kind of changed what they did defensively. And all of a sudden, Peyton Manning gets hot, puts up 349 yards passing. And remember that Bill Belichick, he always seems like he has the answer to how to play Peyton Manning. Like, Peyton never has the big games against Belichick that he usually does against other teams. Not in this game. The Colts put up 455 yards of total offense. That doesn't happen. They come back, they beat the Patriots 38-34, and then go on to beat the Bears in the Super Bowl. And again, in the second half, the Patriots' offense completely changed. It was punts, it was turnovers, it was fumbles. These comebacks, you have to have something that changes, something that tweaks it and gets it going. Our number one entry on our Daily Dose Top 5 NFL playoff collapses. It's the biggest one ever. The 1992 AFC wildcard game. The Houston Oilers, not the Houston Texans, not the Tennessee Titans or whatever. The Houston Oilers are up in the third quarter. I want you to just stop and think about this. They are up 35-3 in the third quarter. This game is in Buffalo. One of those snowy days, blustery days, snowflakes in the air. Everything that you would expect to be Bills football, except for everything's going wrong. The Bills don't have their starter. Jim Kelly is out. Frank Reich is in. And somehow, the Bills get hot. And remember, if you remember this Houston Oilers team, and they were the victim of a lot of comebacks, because they kind of ran that offense that was pass first. And if it was a possession kind of game, they weren't always the most comfortable in that sort of situation. You had Warren Moon. You had Curtis Duncan, Haywood Jeffries, Drew Hill. You had a group that they liked to just drop back and throw the ball over the place. But when you got into a tight game like this, it seemed like it kind of changed the way that they played. And all of a sudden, we can't generate first downs, and we can't control the time of possession. and everything we do well is now out the window. The Bills outscore them 38-3 down the stretch and come back and win 41-38. You know what I remember about this game? Is I remember the Bills actually took the lead. I think they took the lead 38-35 in regulation. And the Oilers get the ball back, and now they're back in their comfort zone where they say, okay, we're going to attack, we're going to go down the field, we're going to try to score. But what I remember about this game is they went down the field, they were getting chunks of yardage, they were moving the football, and then when they got into field goal range, they kind of just said, okay, good enough. Let's just kick it, tie it, go into overtime, and we'll win it. And I remember thinking, as a young kid who had no idea what I was even watching, as a young kid watching this game and thinking, if they settle for a field goal here instead of trying to get to the end zone, they will lose this game. There is no question. And I had that same thought when I was watching the Packers-Seahawks game, when the Packers are driving, they're inside the five, they're inside the two, and then they're settling for field goals. And I'm thinking, first half, early on, if they're settling for field goals here, they are going to lose this game. And that is exactly what happened. The Oilers settled for a 26-yard field goal. They get into overtime. And you knew the Bills were going to win that. There was no question about that. But the biggest comeback in postseason history, the 1992 AFC wildcard game, Oilers up 35-3, and the Bills come back and beat them 41-38. Nobody, and I mean nobody, chokes away a win like the Houston Oilers used to do. They just had a knack for it. They just had a skill for it. They found ways to lose games late. Gonna move on to a big Daily Dose top five here. I think you guys will like this one. I am going to give you my Daily Dose top five most underrated NFL quarterbacks of all time. I want you to think about that for a minute. Because, our rating of NFL quarterbacks, I've told you in the past, it's flawed. The way that we kind of base who's the greatest quarterback, who's the greatest quarterback of all time, it's a little bit flawed the way we do these things. Because when we think of, I want you to think of right now, who are the greatest quarterbacks to ever play the game? Who are the greatest quarterbacks ever? Well, it's got to be who has the most championships, right? I mean, Brady has four. He's been to more than anyone else. Well, no, Montana has four and he never lost any. I mean, Brady lost a few. Montana never lost, so it's got to be them. But we only apply this logic when it suits us. Now, if you turn on your local radio today, or you turn on ESPN or one of these shows, or First Take or whatever these shows are, they're going to get in this discussion and they're going to say, well, it's Montana, it's Brady, it's Unitas, maybe a couple might say it's Manning or it's whoever, but we don't really apply logic that makes much sense. I want you to think about this. We say it's Brady or Montana or somebody like that because they've got four. Terry Bradshaw has four. How come Terry Bradshaw's not on the list? When you look at his stats, of course, he threw 212 touchdowns and 210 interceptions for his career, but, he won four. And how come Otto Graham's not on the list? Otto Graham won seven championships. We don't mention that. Because, when we consider quarterbacks, we don't talk about, there are 21 other guys on this field. Now, when you are comparing, you can't just look at just strictly numbers. It doesn't make any sense to do that. You have to consider the situation that these guys are in. And let me explain what I mean. I heard someone recently, they were talking about Sugar Ray Robinson, who I believe is the greatest fighter to ever fight. Pound for pound, greatest fighter ever. And I'm going to be honest, I don't think it's that close. They talked about how, well, Ray Robinson, back in his day, he was training like picking up cement blocks and like bags of cement and stuff like that. That was his training. Where, as someone like Floyd Mayweather, he's training with like the state of the art, most recent, most new equipment. Okay. But to be fair, let's swap them. So let's bring Ray Robinson up here to 2015 and let's let him train with the greatest equipment. And he only has to fight, 40 times in his career against, let's be fair, below average competition. And let's see how he does. Because I have a feeling he's going to be pretty good. And On that same token, let's take someone like Floyd Mayweather and let's put him back in the 40s and 50s. And you're going to be the guy lifting up the cement bags. And you're going to be fighting 200 fights over 25 years. How's he going to do? Do you see when we swap them how it kind of changes your opinion on things? Because I have a feeling Ray Robinson would do pretty well today. He would be pretty good using that. We can't just sit there and say, well, back in his day, he didn't get to do all that. Okay, well, then let's let him do some of those things. Because he'd be pretty good. Ray Robinson fought 200 fights, had 175 wins, and 110 of them were by knockout. So when we switch these things, it kind of changes our perspective on who's the greatest. Because when I look at the weapons that Joe Montana had, he's pretty loaded. He's got it made. He's playing for one of the greatest coaches ever, bar none. One of the greatest offensive minds ever in the game. A guy that changed the game in Bill Walsh. Do you think other quarterbacks couldn't have gone in there and succeeded? I've got news for you. I look at Tom Brady playing for Bill Belichick, and you can say whatever you want about Belichick. He's a cheater. He's this. He's that. He's a jerk. Whatever. He wins, and he's really, really good. He's changing the game in the NFL. But are you telling me some of these other guys couldn't have gone in and played for Bill Belichick and been pretty good? Matt Cassel played for a season under Bill Belichick and went like 11-5 and got him to the playoffs. You're telling me some of these other quarterbacks couldn't do the same thing? They just didn't have that much around them. They just didn't have as much talent offensively, defensively, coaching-wise around them. Because if they had, they'd be pretty good too. Let me give you my top five most underrated quarterbacks of all time. And when I say underrated, please understand this. Some of these guys are in the Hall of Fame. You're going to say they're not underrated. They're rated. They're in the Hall of Fame. How could they be underrated? But they will never, ever be in the conversation of greatest quarterbacks ever. They won't ever be in that conversation because they didn't win as much as we say, or we just forgot about them. Either way. Case in point. Number five. Here's a guy that faced some of the top defenses, maybe of all time, playing in the 70s and 80s. Played in an era when passing, you didn't pass like we do these days. Now everybody's throwing it all over. It wasn't a passing league at this time. But from 1978 to 1984, Dan Fouts was putting up about 300 yards a game. Had 254 touchdowns. And he takes a lot of heat because they say, well, you had that high-powered offense. And he did have some players on his offense. I mean, Dan Fouts was throwing to John Jefferson, Charlie Joyner, one of the greatest tight ends, maybe the greatest tight end ever, Kellen Winslow. He had Wes Chandler. He had Chuck Muncy when he wasn't, you know, getting arrested. But here's the thing for Dan Fouts. Name one player that was on Dan Fouts' defense. He didn't have any players on his defense. I don't have any yet. He had to go outscore anybody because he didn't have a, who, Louis Kelcher? Who are you going to bring up? He didn't have a defense. He certainly didn't have the defenses that Belichick rolls out. He certainly didn't have the defenses that Montana had playing on the other side of him. And what I remember the most about Dan Fouts, dude was so tough, would get hammered. And I mean, you know, you're playing against some of those Raider teams. You're playing against even some of those Orange Crush Bronco teams. Would get blasted, would get knocked down, wouldn't get up, would stay down for a few minutes, would stagger back into the huddle. Is he going to play? I think he's going to come out. I think he's coming out of the game. I think Dan Fouts is done. He'd get up and throw a touchdown. Went to the Pro Bowl 6 times, was a 2-time NFL MVP. Dan Fouts is underrated. He will never be put in the upper echelon because he didn't win the big game. But sometimes it's not just the quarterback. You got to have some help or you can't do it. Speaking of guys that did not ever get enough help, my number four entry on most underrated quarterbacks. He'll never get talked about with the big dogs. But if you were to put this guy on those San Francisco teams, you're telling me Jim Kelly couldn't have won a few Super Bowls? He took Buffalo to 4 Super Bowls. And to even get a team, let alone Buffalo, to even get a team to 4 Super Bowls is honestly amazing. People forget that Jim Kelly played 2 really, really good years when he first came out of college from Miami in the USFL. And that USFL, a lot of kids hear that now, and they're like, the USFL, what was that, like an arena league? No, it was where some of the best players were going to play. the Herschel Walkers, the Reggie Whites, some of the greatest players, NFL Hall of Fame players went to the USFL because they had a ton of money at the time. When you look around the league and you see some of these teams running the no huddle and they walk to the line and they read the defense and they see what the defense is in, they might even step under center and start to call signals, and then they'll step back and say, okay, what are they in? Okay, let's change the play. Let's audible to the correct play and let's run it. That started with Jim Kelly. It wasn't the Oregon thing where he walked to the line, started to call it, looked over to his coaches, and they showed him like a picture of Mickey Mouse. It wasn't that. Jim Kelly walked to the line, read it himself, got the team into the correct play, and went 101-59 as a starter. Had 237 touchdowns. Holds the record for most yards per completion in a single game. Do you realize that in 1995, Jim Kelly averaged 44 yards per pass in a single game against the Carolina Panthers? Went to 5 Pro Bowls and actually won in Buffalo. Nobody wins in Buffalo. Joe Ferguson couldn't win in Buffalo. Nobody wins in Buffalo. Jim Kelly won in Buffalo. He took Buffalo to 4 Super Bowls. Again. You going to tell me if you plugged him in with Bill Belichick, Jim Kelly wouldn't be pretty good? I've got news for you. He'd be pretty good. Number 3 on my list. Speaking of winning with horrible franchises, here's a guy who won in St. Louis. Here's a guy who took Arizona to the Super Bowl. And he almost won the Super Bowl. Kurt Warner is number 3 with all-time passer rating at a 93.17 rating. You know who number 2 is? Kurt Warner's number 3. Number 2 is Peyton Manning. Number 4 is Tom Brady. Kurt Warner was so deadly accurate. And I realize we kind of have the mentality of, well, yeah, but he had the right system and he completed 65% of his passes in his career. Not one season, in his career, 65%. He averaged 8.11 yards per pass. That is 5th best in history. And his legacy took kind of a hit. Remember in like, what was that, 2001? The Rams go to the Super Bowl against kind of this unknown Patriot team. And Kurt Warner, he had some problems, didn't play that well, had a couple of turnovers, and they lose. And we all thought, oh man, they lost to this upstart Patriot team that really isn't that good. Well, that loss doesn't look so bad now, does it? Especially when he turned around, went to the Giants, floated around a few years, went to Arizona and led Arizona to a Super Bowl. 208 touchdowns in his career. Kurt Warner is one of the most underrated quarterbacks ever. Number 2 on my list. Most underrated NFL quarterbacks ever. Let me tell you how underrated this guy is. He's not even in the NFL Hall of Fame. And he's forgotten because he played on such bad teams. He played on horrible teams. I will challenge you. Name a player he played with. Faced vicious, vicious defenses. My number 2 most underrated quarterback of all time played on those horrible Cincinnati Bengal teams. Kenny Anderson. And Ken Anderson had to face the Steel Curtain at least twice a year, every single year. And you know, in 1974, Ken Anderson faced the Pittsburgh Steelers, one of the greatest defenses ever assembled. And he went 20-22 in a win over Pittsburgh. 90.9 completion percentage. Second highest completion percentage in a single game ever. Kenny Anderson led the league in passer rating 4 different times. In 1974, 75, 81, and 82. Only Sammy Baugh, Steve Young did it more. They did it 6. Ken Anderson holds the single season record for completion percentage with 70.6 in 1982. And again, I challenge you, name one other player that Ken Anderson ever played with. Ken Riley? I don't know. I don't know. I can't name another player. I don't know any of those Cincinnati. Was Pete Johnson on those? I don't have any idea. I don't know who was on those teams, but I know Kenny Anderson is one of the most underrated players ever. He should be in the NFL Hall of Fame. My number one player, most underrated NFL quarterback, is a guy that when I say the name, like my underrated basketball player, you're going to say, well, we remember him, sort of, but he's kind of just forgotten. We kind of forget, and we don't really put together the full story of how good he is. Like I said before, I challenge you, name the greatest quarterback of all time. Joe Montana? Tom Brady? Maybe you say Peyton Manning. Maybe you're a little bit older and you say Johnny Unitas. Maybe you say someone like John Elway or someone like that. This guy never gets mentioned. But he has the best postseason passer rating in NFL history. His postseason passer rating, 104.8. He was 9-1 in the postseason. And people will say, well, yeah, but his teams only ran the ball. And they won because they had a great coach and they ran the ball constantly. But let me give you three championship seasons. First season, his team rushing the ball ran the ball for 3.4 yards per attempt. That was 11th in the league. They passed for 8.2 yards per pass attempt. That was second in the league. Second championship season, they ran for 3.5 yards, which was 14th in the league. They passed for 8.9 yards, which was first in the league. And his last championship season, they ran for 4 yards per carry. That was fourth in the league. And they passed for 8.3 yards per pass. That was first in the league. Do you see the disparity? We think of this team as just a running team. They're pretty good passing the ball. They didn't pass as often, but he was really, really good when he did. Averaged 7.85 yards per pass attempt for his career. Now, let me throw out some other numbers for you. 7.85 yards per pass. Dan Marino, 7.37. Joe Montana, 7.52. Roger Staubach, 7.67. Terry Bradshaw, 7.17. Tom Brady, 7.4. This player, 7.85. His overall record was 94-57. And he won 5 championships, not 4. He won 5, including 3 championships in a row. My most underrated quarterback of all time doesn't get thrown in that conversation. Isn't talked about with the same deity that some of these other guys are thrown out there with. But Bart Starr was a really, really good quarterback and a really underrated quarterback. Bart Starr wins my most underrated quarterback of all time. As we do every single week, we've got to get to our Daily Dose Top 5. Our Daily Dose Top 5 this week, I don't know if you realize this, and you might not. Do you know that tomorrow is International Left-Handers Day? Tomorrow on Thursday? International Left-Handers Day. Are you lefty? Are you left-handed? You know, when I was a kid playing sports, I always wanted to be left-handed. I really did. Left-handed quarterbacks, I don't know why, but they threw just a little bit different of a pass. It looked a little bit pretty. Left-handed, you know, baseball, in baseball, when you're a batter or a pitcher, I don't know what it is about a left-handed batter, but a left-handed batter, just a prettier swing. Left-handed pitcher, obviously a little bit tougher to hit. And then, you know, like basketball and stuff, it seemed like you could always get your shot off a little easier if you were a lefty. I always wanted to be left-handed. My dad was left-handed. And so I think that's why I always wanted to be that. But because it is, International Left-Handers Day tomorrow, if you're a lefty, enjoy the day. I thought we would count down the top 5 greatest left-handed quarterbacks of all time. Top 5 greatest left-handed quarterbacks. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're going to say, this is just an excuse for you to put Tim Tebow on a list. No, I'm not going there. I'm not putting Tim Tebow on this list. He didn't make the list. But here we go. Our Daily Dose Top 5. Greatest left-handed quarterbacks ever. First off, I would like to say this. I'm going to hand out an honorable mention. And the only reason I'm going to hand out this honorable mention is because there was a player that did not make our list, and I'll tell you why. Because he just wasn't good enough. His record wasn't good enough, but he was so much fun to watch. Our honorable mention is going to go to the Seattle Seahawks quarterback, Jim Zorn. Jim Zorn played back in the 70s when the Seattle Seahawks were just forming. I know right now, Seattle, if you're a Seattle Seahawks fan today, you just went, who? I know, Jim Zorn. They have no idea who that is. Like, the last quarterback they remember is Russell Wilson, and that's the only quarterback they even know who it is. Yeah, Jim Zorn was a pretty good lefty back for Seattle back in the day, back in the 70s, early 80s. Jim Zorn had 111 touchdowns. He was a scrambler. He was an exciting quarterback to watch. Threw for 21,000 yards. Problem with Zorn, his winning percentage wasn't great. He was playing for a startup franchise. They were just getting going. The Seahawks struggled early on. His overall winning record was 44-62. And so he didn't quite make our list, but Jim Zorn, I know as a kid watching Jim Zorn, they put, the Seattle Seahawks, they put him in the West, I think originally, and then they switched him over to the AFC West. So here in Denver, we saw the Seattle Seahawks a lot. I saw Jim Zorn a lot. Guy was an amazing, amazing quarterback. And you might remember him from his coaching fiasco when he tried to coach the Redskins. But back in the day, Jim Zorn was pretty good. Moving forward, our number five greatest left-handed quarterback ever. Number five, this guy, I think, is still in the league, but I've got to get him in there. Stats-wise, 131 touchdowns, 22,000 yards passing, played with the Falcons, played with the Eagles, played with the Jets. Michael Vick, another guy that was just so, so exciting to watch. You know, Mike Vick has over 6,000 yards rushing the football. Pretty solid record. 59-50-1, 54% of the games that he played in. I guess the thing with Vic that you always looked at was you always kind of felt like you're so close to just being great, but he never quite took that next step. Obviously put up some huge numbers, was a pain to try to defend in his prime, and then obviously had the issues legally and the problems that took him out of football for a while. But Michael Vick, definitely one of the greatest left-handed quarterbacks ever to play. Number four on our list of greatest left-hand quarterbacks. And here's a guy that probably won more than you think he did. This guy had 184 touchdowns, threw for over 32,000 yards, and won 52% of his games. Granted, he didn't play as many games, but when he was with Jacksonville, Mark Brunell was pretty good. And I remember vividly in 96, Mark Brunell leading a Jaguars team that had no business coming into Denver and beating the Broncos in a wild card playoff game or in a divisional playoff game, came in here, just went crazy on Denver. We all remember the long pass to Jimmy Smith. Mark Brunell was a guy that I don't know if he gets put into, some of the upper echelon of quarterbacks. I'm not going to say he's one of the greats, but Mark Brunell's a pretty darn good quarterback. Won 52% of his games, 78-73 as a starter. Mark Brunell, pretty good lefty. Number three on our list. And this guy, I think, gets a little bit of a bad rap. Now, some of his bad rap is because he's gone into the announcing thing, and sometimes his mouth gets him into trouble. But playing for two bad franchises with the Bengals and the Jets, Boomer Esiason threw for 247 touchdowns in his career. He had 37,000 yards, and he was 80-93 as a starter, but he played on bad teams, bad franchises, didn't have a ton of help, took the Cincinnati Bengals to the Super Bowl. Let me repeat that. Took the Cincinnati Bengals to the Super Bowl. I mean, there's got to be something said for a guy that can do that. Also had some success with the Jets, which, as we can see with Geno Smith, is not exactly the easiest thing that you could do. Boomer Esiason, very, very good. Big, strong kid. Big arm, but I can remember a number of times watching Boomer. I think he's a guy that's a little bit underrated only because he played on such bad teams. He didn't always get to play on big teams and with big-time talent. The players around him, who was playing on those Cincinnati teams, who was playing with him? James Brooks? I don't even know. Icky Woods. I mean, it wasn't like he was surrounded with a ton of talent, but Boomer Esiason was always made the team pretty respectable and tough. Tough as nails. Guy would get hit, get up, go back to the line of scrimmage, and do it all over again. Very, very tough guy. Very, very good left-handed quarterback, Boomer Esiason. Number two on our list. Now, I put this guy at number two. And when I read his stats, you're going to say, well, he shouldn't even be at three or four. I'm just going to read his stats. I mean, because you look at Boomer Esiason, 247 touchdowns, 37,000 yards. This guy, to quote John Gruden, 194 touchdowns, only had 28,000 yards. But his record stands on its own. This guy should be in the NFL Hall of Fame. This is another one of those guys that is getting passed over for the Hall of Fame because all we are doing is looking at statistics and we say, oh, well, his statistics don't add up. I don't care. I could care less about his statistics. I can look at things and with my eyes, I can judge and say, this is a guy that belongs in the NFL Hall of Fame. This is a guy that should be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame because what he did and his winning record, his record as a starter, 96-49-1. 64% of the games he played and he won. Ken Stabler should be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Ken Stabler, definitely one of the greatest left-handed quarterbacks to ever play the game. And again, when you look back at guys, he won a Super Bowl. So it's not like you sit there and say, well, he didn't win any Super Bowls. The only team that was beating him out for the Super Bowl was the Pittsburgh Steelers that was loaded with all this talent. And it would either be the Steelers or the Raiders getting by every year. Those were the epic battles. Those were the things that was the only thing that kept Ken Stabler from winning more Super Bowls were those loaded 70s Steelers teams. Ken Stabler, I mean, the things that he did with the Raiders, the wins that he got at the last second, the way that he carried that team. I'm saying this as a Denver Bronco fan. I hate the Raiders. Ken Stabler belongs in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Amazing, amazing career. And his win-loss record speaks for itself. Get away from the stats thing. I don't care about the stats. You can't write the history of the NFL without those 70s Raiders teams and without Ken Stabler. You cannot do it. It's impossible to do. Ken Stabler ought to be in the Hall of Fame. Now, you might be sitting there saying, okay, well, who's number one? Best left-handed quarterback ever? Tim Tebow? I don't know. No, it's not Tim Tebow. I told you I wasn't putting him on the list. I might put him on one of the best college quarterbacks ever, but no, he doesn't make the list. Our number one greatest left-handed quarterback, again, these numbers speak for themselves, 232 touchdowns, 33,000 yards. This guy had 4,000 yards rushing the football. And his record, right there with Stabler, 94-49. He won 66% of his games. Steve Young, I got to put him down as the greatest left-handed quarterback who has ever played the game. Steve Young was an amazing player. And you know, when he was younger, when he first came into the league, there was talk that maybe he should play running back. He was that good of a runner. He sat behind Joe Montana, learned Bill Walsh's offense, got that Bill Walsh system down. And when he got his opportunity, there is no question Steve Young made the most of his chances, took the 49ers to the Super Bowl, put up huge, video game numbers on that march to the Super Bowl. Steve Young, our greatest left-handed quarterback of all time. So for all of you left-handers, hope you enjoyed that left-handed list. Now, as we do every single week, we have got to get to our Daily Dose Top 5. You know, Mike and I talked about it. The Denver Broncos have a bit of a quarterback situation. Is it a quarterback controversy? I don't know. Both Peyton Manning, Brock Osweiler, they're both saying the right things. And if there's anything I think that comes out of this, I've been very, very impressed with Brock Osweiler. I haven't been a huge Brock Osweiler fan. I've been impressed with the way he's carried himself and the way he's presented himself during all this. He gets benched on Sunday. They ask him, you get benched. Do you feel bad about getting pulled when, you know, these turnovers weren't your fault? And he's, it's not about me. That was his answer. It's not about me. It's about the team. If it helps the team, I'm all for it. I give him a lot of credit. You know, Peyton Manning doesn't want to be sitting on the sideline. He hasn't said that. He's, hey, I'm trying to help Brock in whatever way I can. I know the media has tried to present that Peyton Manning is bitter and he doesn't want to travel to games. That hasn't been how this has gone down. These guys are at least saying the right things. I know they want to start because if you're a quarterback at the level that these guys are playing at, I mean, you've been the stud in Little League. You've been the stud in high school. You've been the stud at your college. You've been, your whole life, you've been the guy. And now you have another quarterback trying to take your job. It's not easy. These guys have been saying the right things. That's not always the case, though. Today, our Daily Dose Top 5, going to talk about some of those times when they've been a little nastier. Today's Daily Dose Top 5, the top 5 bitter quarterback controversies of all time. Number 5, you might remember this one. The Buffalo Bills in 1999. You know, in 1998, Rob Johnson was the starter. He was the starter going into 1999. In 98, the Bills had also brought in Doug Flutie. You remember Doug Flutie? He had won the Heisman. He had tried to get on with some teams in the NFL. It hadn't really worked. He had gone up and played in the CFL and had thrown all over the place and had a phenomenal career in the Canadian Football League, had won some titles, done some things, came back down to Buffalo and signed with the Bills. Now, the Bills were 4-1 in 99, and Rob Johnson gets hurt. Flutie comes on in relief of Johnson, and the Bills go 8-3 under Flutie. They make the playoffs. In the final game of the year, the Bills are going to play the Indianapolis Colts. It's a meaningless game. There's nothing to be gained from the Bills winning this game. And so they decide to rest all their starters. They rest Doug Flutie and they put Johnson in. And Johnson does okay. He throws for almost 300 yards. He has a couple touchdowns and they win the game. Based on that performance, head coach Wade Phillips decides Rob Johnson is going to be the starter in the playoff game next week. Flutie was furious, felt that he hadn't done anything to lose his starting position. Rob Johnson went in. They end up losing to the Tennessee Titans. Bills fans were mad. Flutie is still mad, I think. And you know, the Buffalo Bills haven't been back to the playoffs since. That's a long time. They still haven't been to the playoffs. They're not going this year either. Buffalo Bills in 1999, quarterback controversy got a little bit ugly, got a little bit bitter. Moving on to number 4. Number 4, the Pittsburgh Steelers in 1974. You know, Terry Bradshaw was the quarterback in 74. But in 74, there was a players walkout, there was a player strike, and while players were out, 11th round draft pick Joe Gilliam crossed the picket line. And when he crossed the picket line, he came in with Pittsburgh, and this was back when you played, you know, 37 preseason games. The Steelers went 6-0 under Gilliam in the preseason. And then they started off the season. The players still haven't reported. And the Steelers were 4-1-1 under Gilliam. When the players came back, Gilliam was demoted when the strike got settled. Bradshaw was put back up on top of the list. There were a number of people that looked at this and said, was this racially motivated? Was this a union bias because Gilliam crossed the lines? They didn't know exactly what it was. Gilliam ended up having a drug addiction problem, having all these problems. He was out of the league after just 1 year. And we know what Bradshaw did. He ended up leading the Steelers to 4 Super Bowls. But there was a lot of bitterness around the Pittsburgh Steelers in 1974 when Joe Gilliam got benched for Terry Bradshaw. Number 3 on our list. Just back in 2008, not that long ago. You know, in 2005, Brett Favre started hinting to the Green Bay Packers, I think I might retire. In fact, there was a couple times he even announced he was going to retire. 2006, he did the same. 2007, he did the same. He just kept saying, yeah, I think I'm going to retire. I think I'm going to give it up. Well, in 2005, the Packers, thinking Favre, he's going to, you know, retire sometime. He kept saying he was going to. They decided they would draft Cal quarterback Aaron Rodgers. And Favre hated the pick. Refused to help Rodgers at all when he came in the league. He always said, why would I help the guy that's going to take my job? So he never would help Rodgers. In 2008, Favre again had announced he was going to retire. And so the Packers, it's kind of started to move forward. Okay, Rodgers is our guy. At the last second, Favre says, no, I'm coming back. And the Packers said, okay, that's great, but you're the backup. We've already got everything installed for Aaron Rodgers. Favre got mad. He has to be traded. I certainly am not going to be a backup to this guy. So the Packers traded Brett Favre to the New York Jets for a 4th round pick. He bounced around to a few other teams. Meanwhile, Aaron Rodgers has obviously come on and had a phenomenal career of his own. Things in Green Bay, quarterback controversy there was not always friendly, was a little bit bitter. Speaking of bitter, let's move on to number 2 on our list. The Dallas Cowboys in 1971. Now, this one's kind of weird. This one's kind of odd. In 1970, the Dallas Cowboys went to the Super Bowl. They lose it, I think it was Super Bowl 5 to the Colts, and Craig Morton had been their quarterback. But in 71, they had Roger Staubach. And Staubach and Morton both had phenomenal preseasons. Like, they both playing really, really well. So well, in fact, that head coach Tom Landry didn't know who to start. And he couldn't quite decide who to start. So what did he do? He didn't decide who to start. He alternated every game. He would start Morton, and then he would start Staubach. And then he would start Morton, and then he would start Staubach. And through the first six games, they were 4-2. And there was some grumbling. The quarterbacks didn't like it. The fans didn't like it. Pick a quarterback, go with one guy. So Landry decided, I'm going to actually just alternate them on every single play of the game. And the Cowboys played the Bears. And he alternated them on every play. Now remember, this was before the radio headsets. He was having a quarterback on the sideline with him. He would tell him the play, hey, look for this and this and this, and then he'd send him in the game and bring the other. They were alternating every single play. And both quarterbacks hated it. In fact, Roger Staubach said that he thought maybe something had happened to Landry. He said, I didn't know if he had Alzheimer's or what, because it didn't make any sense. Both quarterbacks hated it. The Cowboys got beat by the Bears, and Landry finally was forced to make a decision. He went with Staubach. Staubach ended up taking the Cowboys to 5 Super Bowls, and he won 2 of them. That one was kind of ugly. Staubach and Morton ended up kind of having that bitter rivalry, too. They faced each other in the Super Bowl in 77. Our final bitter quarterback controversy. Now, understand this. I don't know if these players hated each other. I don't think that they did. They're both smart guys. This was more about the fan base bitterness, because the fan base hated this one. Our number one bitter quarterback controversy, just in 1992. You know, Joe Montana had led the San Francisco 49ers to 4 Super Bowls and had won all of them. But he was injured in 1991. He had hurt his elbow pretty significantly, and he missed a lot of time. Steve Young came in 91, and in 92, Steve Young was the starter. Montana was still battling some health issues. Young went 14-2 in 92. He was the NFL MVP, but the Niners lost in the NFC Championship to the Dallas Cowboys. Montana came back in 93 and was like, okay, I'm back. I'm ready to be the starter. Now, everyone's like, well, we don't know who the starter is going to be. Who should be the starter? Young is playing out of his mind. He had one of the highest quarterback ratings in NFL history. We went 14-2. Yes, we lost to the Cowboys. Whereas Montana supporters were saying, Montana doesn't lose to anybody. Dude's 4-0 in the Super Bowl. And in the Super Bowl, he's been nails. This guy just, all he does is win. How'd he decide here? Fans hated it. Fans were completely split. You were either a Montana guy or you were a Young guy. And there was a bitter rivalry there. In 93, the Niners finally ended up trading Joe Montana to the Chiefs. Some 49er fans are still mad. Montana went to the Chiefs. He was okay with the Chiefs. Steve Young ended up leading the San Francisco 49ers to a Super Bowl and having a phenomenal career once he was named the starter. But it was really, really bitter there for a while in San Francisco. There is our number one top 5 bitter quarterback controversies. Hey, next week on The Dose, we will, of course, be keeping you up with all that happens in the world of sports. We've got the Major League Baseball playoffs. We've got the NFL. We've got college football. We've got the NBA getting going. We've got a number of things to talk. So be sure that you tune in next week on The Daily Dose. We will catch you all up, get you back on top of all things sports, as only we can do. Make sure you stop by The Daily Dose and be sure you let a friend do the same. Hey, I want to say thank you to each and every one of you for listening to The Daily Dose every week. Thank you for the emails. Thank you for the text. Thank you for the tweets. Thank you for going over to DailyDoseSports.com and checking out all the new things going on over there. But more than anything, thank you for sharing the podcast, for sharing the videos, for sharing the articles with someone that you know. We absolutely love it when you do that. I have to say thank you to JSP. Could not do any of this without you. I will see you all next Wednesday. Have a great week, everybody.